Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy it. Today we have part two of a three-part presentation of the story of Cottage Grove aviation legend Jim Wright. Yesterday, in part one, we set the scene and talked about Mr. Wright's early life and his goal of recreating what may have been the most interesting aircraft of the first half of the 20th century, the Hughes Racer. Today, we'll walk through the process he followed to make that dream a reality. First, though, let's talk about Howard Hughes. Hughes is still best remembered today as a reclusive and aged billionaire with severe mental health issues. Although that description hardly fit Jim Wright, the Cottage Grove entrepreneur shared several positive traits with the long-dead aviation pioneer. He had the same lean, lanky build, the same passion for things well-built and fast, and flying skills that, well, let's face facts, Hughes was one of the best flyers of all time, but Wright was no slouch either. Wright also shared Hughes' ability to get the best out of the people who worked for him. This probably had something to do with Wright's attitude, which was quite a bit different from the "I'm better than you" hit that one usually gets from CEOs. His attitude was more like, "I love people, including myself, and you too." You could see that attitude in his office layout, in his casual style of dress — he greatly favored long-sleeved plaid Western shirts and Panama hats — and in the morale of the people he led. But the most important thing that Wright shared with Hughes was ownership of a machine and tool company. That meant that anything Wright needed, he could simply machine for himself, just as Hughes had done. Now he focused these critical assets on replicating Hughes' airplane. The original had been tucked away in an obscure hangar at Hughes Aircraft immediately after it broke its last record, the Transcontinental record, in 1937, and it had been out of the public sight until 1975, on the eve of Hughes' death, when it was donated to the Smithsonian Institution. Blueprints? Plans? All long gone. But Smithsonian officials Robert Van de Linden and Bill Reese were willing to let Wright's team come to Washington, D.C. and examine the original to reverse engineer a new set of plans. They were even allowed to disassemble parts of the plane to get better measurements, a huge demonstration of trust, as the H-1 is one of the Smithsonian's crown jewels. "The director of the Smithsonian told me that if he could have just one plane in the Smithsonian, it wouldn't be the Wright brothers' flyer," Wright once told a reporter from the Gillette, Wyoming News Record. "It would be the Hughes Racer." Wright assembled a team of experts to help build it. Two of his employees, Guy Ralston and Dennis Parker, worked on computer-aided design drafting so that the parts could be machined by digitally controlled machining mills. He rounded out the team with experienced aircraft builders and flyers Mike Mann, Dave Payne, and Al Sherman, and hired Ron England to direct the team. For a few special tasks, experts had to be hired. A man from Arkansas with legendary skills as a panel beater spent a full year using a ball-peen hammer to beat sheets of aluminum into the highly complicated shape required for the engine cowl. Another old-style craftsman from California carved part of the wooden tail section. A local craftsman, Steve Wolf from Cresswell, spent 3,000 hours building the wings. For the propeller, Wright's team found a vintage Hamilton Standard hub and fitted it with blades from an Italian military plane. Just like Hughes before them, they would have trouble with that propeller. In addition to the subcontracted parts, the team poured 35,000 man-hours into the project, the equivalent of 17 years. Total cost? Just shy of $2 million. But of course, if Wright hadn't owned a machine shop, it would have been much more than that. By the spring of 2002, the plane was finally nearly ready, and Wright was starting to think about getting it into the air. And finally, in mid-June, surrounded by a small group of admiring aviators and the entire newsroom staff of the Cottage Grove Sentinel, the plane was rolled out onto the airfield, and with that smoky belch characteristic of all radial engines, the monstrous power plant started up. Cottage Grove's airport echoed for the first time with the rough, belligerent roar of the Hughes H-1's massive engine. It was the beginning of several months of continuous testing and development. Low-speed taxi testing, medium-speed taxi testing, brake checks, neighboring residents and businesses started getting used to the racket. After the first medium-speed taxi run, reporter Treader found Wright looking distinctly rattled. "The airplane is intimidating. It is incredibly powerful," he said. "I've never had my hand on the throttle of anything that had quite so much power. The Hughes feels scarily powerful. In your mind, you can visualize things going wrong." Wright said he'd fed the engine a bunch of throttle to test the brakes, and the massive torque had tilted the whole airplane, squashing down the landing gear struts. He turned to veteran test pilot and air racer Jimmy Leeward of Leeward Air Ranch in Florida for some help handling his high-powered plane. Leeward flew one of his P-51 Mustangs to Cottage Grove to help. Leeward used the Mustang to fly after Wright's plane and observe how it was flying, helping iron out minor issues in preparation for the H-1's first flight beyond Cottage Grove.
"Overall, there have been very minor problems, and those that have cropped up have been normal teeth-cutting items that happen to any newly constructed plane with only 15 hours of flight time," Leeward wrote in an update letter to All Aviation Flightline Online, which is an enthusiast's website. Leeward didn't mention what those issues were, but at the local paper we did, the tail wheel melted, causing a little repairable damage to the tail. Another thing Leeward didn't mention was Wright's nagging worry that something bigger than a minor problem might be lurking. And indeed, though he kept his positive attitude up at all times, Wright had some reason to suspect there might be a problem with the plane. Hughes' life's biggest passion in his younger days was airplanes. He had built the fastest, best, most exciting airplane in the world. Why didn't he use it? Why did it end up tucked away in an obscure hangar at Hughes Aircraft and forgotten about? It made no sense. It was like Mario Andretti having Ferrari custom build a car for him and then never driving it. There was always the nagging fear that the reason Howard flew the H-1 only 42 hours was because there was some serious problem which he never would have said anything about, Wright told Air and Space magazine. Was there a bear trap waiting for us? If that bear trap were to spring, Wright did not want the local newspaper to be there to witness it, or anybody else for that matter. Perhaps that's why, a few days later, as I sat nursing a cup of coffee early one morning and reading the Eugene Register Guard, I heard the distinctive sound of the plane flying over my house, sounding like a gang of Hell's Angels doing subcontractor work for Santa Claus, only it was July. Yeah, that line is about as close as I'm going to get to the blasted blubber beyond all believable bounds, but at least I have that much in common with Paul Lindman. Back to the story. Jim Wright had left the airfield early that morning for the plane's maiden voyage, heading 70 miles north to Corvallis. No one had told us, so our photographer Jared Pabin wasn't there. Of course, reporter Treader hastened to get an after-the-fact article ready for the next week's paper. In it, Wright painted a glowing picture of the plane's handling in the flight. "What a hoot! It handles so good! It flies just incredible!" he told Treader. "It was going 190 miles an hour at 30% power. You know it's just going to scoot." To scoot, that is, after the propeller problems were ironed out. Mindful of the publicity, Wright didn't tell Treader everything about the flight, but he did dish it up to the Air and Space magazine reporter. It seemed that Wright was getting that 30% power at 100% of the engine's allowable speed because the prop wasn't taking big enough bites of air. As a result, the engine was running uncomfortably hot, and Wright at one point was looking for places to make an emergency landing. Luckily, the temperature stabilized, and he made it to Corvallis. After the champagne celebration was over, Wright got back to work. To let the propeller function as it was supposed to with such a powerful engine, it needed bigger counterweights, one on each propeller blade. Without them, the centrifugal force of the propeller would make the blades take smaller bites of air. Wright put bigger counterweights on the plane, which helped a lot. Not enough, though. In fact, the bigger counterweights might have been the cause of what happened later that year. But we'll save that for part three of this three-part presentation of the story of Jim Wright and his amazing hand-built airplane tomorrow. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Say, are you an audiobook listener? And do you enjoy old pre-war pulp stories like Tarzan of the Apes and Conan the Barbarian and The Call of Cthulhu and stuff like that? Or do you like early Victorian penny dreadful fiction like Sweeney Todd and Varney the Vampire and Highwayman Dick Turpin? If so, you might enjoy the audiobooks I have out there in the world. The easiest way to find them is for the search for my name on audible.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.